Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com. Next.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Lately, the news media has been devoting a lot of time to reporting on itself. And all too often, that's come in the form of a mea culpa.
I want to say personally and directly, I'm sorry.
Or even in charges of moral failure.
A whore is a whore.
A major network purging its ranks, a prominent commentator secretly on the take from the government, the New York Times, the Washington Post, and USA Today, all with major scandals in the last year. And this wasn't exactly a ringing endorsement from the commander-in-chief back in one of October's presidential campaign debates.
In all due respect, I'm not so sure it's credible to quote leading news organizations about... Well, never mind. Anyway.
Public skepticism toward the news media is growing. Suspicion and anger cut across the political spectrum, right, left, and center. Some days, the very role and future of the U.S. press seem on the line. And with that, the major questions on the future of American democracy. Tonight on Point, the media's credibility crisis and what's driving it. We start tonight in New York. Alexandra Marx, staff writer for the Christian Science Monitor, joins me from there. She's been reporting that firings and apologies are not diffusing public discontent with the news media. Alexandra Marx, thanks for being with us tonight.
Well, thank you for having me.
So CBS has taken a very big step here, letting four top staffers go right up to vice presidential level. Last week, Armstrong Williams saying, hey, I won't take any more money, but he'd already taken almost $250,000. You're saying the American public's got a bigger beef than that. They're not cutting the media slack on the basis of that apology, that step down.
Yeah, I think for the last, I'd say, 25, maybe 30 years, the American public has had growing frustration with the media. From Watergate on up, there's this sense that the media has gotten too aggressive, maybe too commercialized, not paying enough attention to details, little things like spelling people's names right, you know, that little errors that everybody could get wrong, but if it's in your local paper and it's you, it feeds frustration. So the media is constantly going in transformations and technology-driven transformations. And the internet has fueled sort of, there was a growing frustration with the media because of the competitiveness brought on by turning it into a profit center. But now, you know, people can go on the internet and they can look all over the world for information. They can share their views about things that they think might be different from what they see on the evening news. So this is just one more sort of stage in the media transformation. And as I said, the media has been in transformation since the printing press. I mean, the introduction of radio, the introduction of television.
Right. It never stops, but the numbers don't look good. You're quoting the Pew Research Center for the People in the Press here, saying even since 1988, a very significant jump in the number of Americans that don't believe political reporting is unbiased, for example.
That's true. It's true. Back in 1988, only 38% of Americans saw political bias, and now as much as 58%. But I think that's also a product of these 24-hour cable channels where no longer they're called news channels, but they're also mostly commentary. People sit around and they talk about their views on this, and they think this is right and they think this is wrong. I've been in journalism, you know, 25 years, not to date myself, but when, you know, in my training, you would never say this is right, this is wrong, I believe this, I believe that, so-and-so is good, so-and-so is bad. There was a...
But opinion is king now. Armstrong Williams had an opinion that the government paid for, $240,000 from the Education Department for this commentator to essentially cheerlead for the No Child Left Behind education policy. To me, that's a new line crossed. That was stunning to me.
I think that was a real tragedy, and I think a personal tragedy for him. But it also says, you know, he should have known. Evidently, someone met him in a green room recently, and he said, "Oh, I just really didn't know you weren't supposed to take money."
Didn't know.
Yeah, and so in a way, there's a crisis in civic education in this country, and I think the failure of the media is part of that, but it's also suffering from it.
Now, you've talked to people right across the political spectrum, even at the Heritage Foundation.
Mm-hmm.
What do people at different points on that spectrum have to say about what's going on?
Well, of course, there's a lot of anger in the conservative circles that this exhaustive study did not find political bias on the part of Rather or CBS. I mean, Rather and CBS have been like the darlings to hate of the conservative world for their supposed liberal media bias. And so there's a lot of frustration. They thought Rather should have lost his job. They thought Andrew Hayward, who's the president of CBS, should have lost his job. On the other hand, you talk to people, sort of liberals and sort of traditional media critics, and they're sort of impressed that CBS went through this whole exhaustive study and basically said, hey, we made a major error, we made a mistake. And so this question of political bias, talk to a reporter and they say, oh, no, it's just making a mistake. They were being determined and pushed by this competitive zeal. They had to get the story on before somebody else got it on, so they weren't being, so it was just stupid mistakes.
Mm.
But then, in conservative circles, they still see a lot of bias and are very angry that that was not recognized.
You talked to the Heritage Foundation's Mark Tapscott, who says news is now a conversation. It's no longer the elite telling us what is important.
Yeah, yeah. I do think that this is, indicative of a major trend, major change. I think the bloggers are making this like a much bigger milestone than it is. But ever since the internet has been a part of reporting, I know that I, and I'm sure you, get emails from listeners and readers. And
sure, we welcome them, yeah.
Feedback. Yeah, of course. And it has changed the media. This is just, just a much bigger example of what many journalists are accustomed to dealing with every day. Someone writing in and saying, well, you left out the fact that, X, Y, or Z in your story.
But this is bigger than an issue of going after a point of accuracy. The Heritage Foundation guy is saying the whole dynamic is shifting. This is what the conservative critique, that what used to be called the press has got this extra label on it now, the elite press, and they're saying they don't own it anymore. They don't own truth. But isn't objectivity supposed to be apart? Aren't facts supposed to be apart from ownership?
Right. Well, this is why I think that they're this, and here I'm giving an opinion.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that the traditional media still has a very, very important role to play. And I do believe that news organizations, despite this rough period, and the media has been through rough periods before, will continue to be the fourth estate. I mean, something that people will turn to get information and information that they trust. And, it's just part of this, the internet is making us all better. It is forcing us all to, you can't be lazy anymore.
I don't know. You sound more hopeful than some of the people you talk to. Ken Auletta, New Yorker magazine.
Yeah.
There's a divide between the media and the people who read or watch or listen to us.
Right.
He said to you, they don't trust us the way they used
to,
and the way they need to in a democracy, he said, where the press is the tool people use to get the information they need to make decisions.
But I guess my point is that they're getting their information other places now as well, and forcing the media to be more responsible. I mean, you can, and I have to say, some of the blogs, I still believe that traditional media outlets serve a very important role because they do have standards. At least, we try to hew to certain ethical standards that where there is sort of this role of parsing out truth. What we think, there is no truth, but objectively and fairly presenting things as they appear to be. Whereas, on the blogs, there's a lot of reading what reinforces what you believe. I quoted some guy from ratherbias.com. Well, even the name
Rather
of the
as
blog,
in Dan Rather Bias,
yeah,
right?
Exactly. Even the name of the blog lets you know what you're reading. You're reading a blog from folks that think that Rather is biased, but at least they know it's colored going in.
Pretty soon you're kind of tumbling in space there. Where's the perpendicular? Where's the objective? Where's the factual account that you can count on?
I think eventually people go back to sources that they know and learn to trust. And what the challenge for the media, and I was hoping to sort of make the point with the Auletta quote at the end, is the challenge for the media, the mainstream media, which I do not think is elite, but the mainstream media, is to find a way to once again regain that trust, to find a way to make readers and viewers feel like They're not getting entertainment or infotainment, as we call it. They're not getting like this sensational crash. And I mean, I used to write about the media all the time. It used to make me crazy. Crime was going down steadily in the 1990s, and people's perceptions of crime was that it was getting worse and worse and worse. And there was a guy out in Colorado, I forgot his name, that had a great study, and it was because people would turn on the evening news, and it would be, you know, the if it bleeds, it leads sort of cliche of bad local news.
And there they'd see it, and in that, ultimately, maybe they learned that they weren't seeing the truth, and that gap opens up. Alexander Marks, thanks very much for your reporting, and thanks for being with us tonight.
Well, it was a great pleasure. Thank you.
Alexander Marks, staff writer for the Christian Science Monitor. She spoke with me from New York. We are talking tonight about the media's credibility crisis, the American press losing the public trust and maybe its interest, and what's driving that erosion. You can join the conversation. Are you feeling a crisis of confidence in the news media? A skepticism that would have surprised you 10, 15 years ago. Why? Join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Los Angeles is Leroy Sievers, visiting professor at the University of California's Annenberg School for Communication. He was for 13 years at ABC's Nightline as producer, senior field producer, and finally executive producer for the last 4.5 years before leaving last November. Leroy Sievers, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Also with me in the studio tonight is On Point news analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Jack, good to have you right here.
Good to be here. Thank you, Jim.
Leroy Sievers, you've been in the thick of this at Nightline. You guys almost had your head handed to you, about a year ago? I don't remember the time when you're almost kicked off so that David Letterman could come over and do evening chat in your spot.
It's about 2.5 years ago.
2.5 years ago now. You must have watched CBS go through this with enormous interest. And you hear, Alexander, you know the kind of loss of public confidence in the media that's underway. How do you interpret what's going on here?
Well, first, I should probably say I was at CBS for almost 10 years, so I know most of the people involved, and some of them are friends. I should say that up front. Mm-hmm. I think the media has changed, the business has changed, but the public has changed too. And I have to say, I mean, I think that as much as lack of confidence is at an all-time high, I think to some extent hypocrisy is as well.
Who's hypocrisy, I mean, Leroy?
Pardon me?
Listener or the whose hypocrisy? Whose?
Both. I mean, you hear, and I saw, you know, Rush Limbaugh and some of the people on Fox sort of ranting about bias at CBS, and the quote that it's not the elite telling people what to think. You listen to Rush Limbaugh, his fans are called ditto heads. He says, you know, this is the truth. I'm telling you, there's a lot of look at what the other guy's doing, but what I'm doing is different. And for the people that believe, whether it's the left, right, center, whatever, that the person they're listening to is right, it's okay because they agree with them. Therefore, what they're saying is correct and factual and unbiased. It's the other guy that's biased. Somehow we've gotten into demonizing the other person. It's not enough to say I disagree with them. They're bad people. They're wrong. They're biased, whatever. And I think that's a fundamental change.
But isn't that fueled by somehow moving away from facts? Once you move off of facts, once you move away from factual reporting, anything's possible. Anyone can charge anything about anybody.
Absolutely. And that happens, and then you can cover that by saying, well, I wasn't questioning the facts of it involved. I was covering the controversy. I was covering the allegations. There are any number of ways to sort of tar people and wreak great havoc.
Jack Beatty, here it is. I mean, all-time high level of mistrust, according to the polls that we're seeing here by the public, of political reporting in particular, but you know it goes more broadly than that. And the consequences of this are enormous. Nobody knows what the firm ground of information is anymore.
No, and the political consequences I think we saw in the last campaign. To me, the document of all documents in journalism this year was that University of Maryland study we've talked about many times that showed that 4,000 Republican voters that showed that these people believed lots of things that simply weren't true, were not factual about the Bush administration, including that the Bush administration was for the Kyoto Protocol on global warming, including that the Bush administration was for the treaty banning landmines. Now, where did they come? How did they come by these easily refutable, wrong thoughts, incorrect, factually incorrect? And it's scary to think that so many believed something that wasn't true. That tells me either the media wasn't telling them that or they weren't believing it.
And yet you look out there and you're getting just the other message. Bill O'Reilly, heard him just today in the car. The free media, that is the mainstream media, is becoming dishonest, he says. That's the crux of the problem. It's that it's the left controls the elite media. And so charge, countercharge. And who's left? Listeners, we're talking tonight about the news media's credibility crisis and what is driving it. You can join the conversation. A major network purging its ranks, a prominent commentator on the take from the government, the New York Times and Washington Post and USA Today, all with major scandals in the past year. What is going on here? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the news media's credibility crisis and what is driving it. You can join the conversation tonight. What is driving down public confidence in the American news media today? Do you remember when you trusted the news more? What has changed? And do you take any news report at face value anymore? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. A new line crossed, at least to my mind, last week when Armstrong Williams, a conservative, happened to be black commentator, revealed that he had taken $240,000 from the United States Department of Education to, what do you want to call it, cheerlead, shill, for the No Child Left Behind Act. When CNN's founding president, Reish Schoenfeld, heard that, he was talking with NPR's David Folkenflik about it, he was pretty straightforward in how he assessed it. Here's what he had to say.
A whore is a whore, and when you're paid to put out an opinion without announcing to the world that you've been paid out to do it, that's not only whoring, but it's pretending to virtue while you're doing it.
A whore is a whore. That is pretty straightforward, but there's a lot of mystery about exactly what's going on with standards in the American media and the American public's trust of that media. You can join the conversation, 1-800-423-8255. I'm joined tonight in the studio by our own Jack Beatty from Los Angeles, by Leroy Sievers, former executive producer of ABC's Nightline, and right now from Teaneck, New Jersey, by Michael Hoyt, executive editor of the Columbia Journalism Review. Michael Hoyt, thanks for being with us tonight.
I'm glad to be here.
What do you make of this big yawning gap in the public's trust of the media and this series of major mea culpas? We had a couple just in the last week, but in the last year, the New York Times about Jason Blair, the Washington Post, front page story saying we failed to report on the situation in Iraq and what was going on before the war there, USA Today with having to back away from a very prominent reporter, say he'd made all kinds of things up. What's going on with the media and public trust in the media?
Well, it certainly does feel like a moment, but it's a moment in a sort of continuum that's been going on for a while. I think there are a lot of underlying reasons that some that aren't the fault of the media at all. Some are just economic and social. For one thing, there's just so much media, and it's fragmented, and people are media are competing for your attention, and they're so in your face. There's there's a sort of a tendency to push it away. I also think there's a sort of a distrust. This is a time of a period of distrust in institutions, big institutions anyway, and media is certainly big. There's a blurring going on as part of this fragmentation between opinion and fact and between good journalism and trash. And people a lot of times tend to see the whole thing and don't, separate the Washington mm-hmm. Post from the New York Post from the reality show and so forth. And the biggest thing is we're in a polarized nation, which is a complicated thing. The question of bias and so forth. Someone mentioned earlier that readers, viewers may be changing. I think that's true. We had a piece in our magazine in the current issue that raised that question. Are people less connected to community and civic life for a lot of complicated reasons than they used to be, and therefore less attached to news? I think it's a good question.
Does that make people somehow more gullible, more willing to believe anything, or more interested in entertainment over facts? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I think they're just a little less attached to civic life, and therefore that's what news is about. I also think in our society the speed of change is so great that I sometimes think people gravitate to opinion. Part of the reason that's happening is to try to find meaning out of all this all this media, all this news that's swirling around.
So much information, so go for opinion. But Leroy Sievers, I wonder if there's not also a kind of concerted attack here. When you hear, as we just heard from Rush Limbaugh or from Bill O'Reilly, relentlessly going after the mainstream media, calling it elite, calling it dishonest, it's as if there's a campaign to say, you can't believe the media, you can't believe anybody, so listen to us and we'll guide you through.
Oh, of course. It works. It's relentless. And what better way than actually disagreeing with someone or challenging their actions than simply dismiss them entirely? They're biased. There was a study done in a southern city, which a focus group of people were shown a number of pieces, one of which was was coverage of John Kerry's campaign.
Mm-hmm.
And that group came across and said, biased report. And the people said, why? And they said, well, you covered John Kerry. And I would guess if you reversed, if you found a group of people somewhere else in a quote, blue state and showed them a report of the Bush campaign, they might have said the same thing. We've lost the idea that it's okay to listen to people that disagree with you, that it's okay to have a difference of opinion. What I think a lot of people want is just to hear what they agree with. They want someone to say, yes, you're right, we agree with you. And it's gotten to the point where anyone that says anything else, just having them on is a sign of bias.
So,
and I think that's a terrible danger for this country.
Michael Hoyt, then, has that been fed by the media? Are they sort of feeding their own monster here? Have they succumbed to that? If the media really relentlessly puts the facts out there, is that an antidote to the problem?
Yeah, it can be, but it's tough. I agree. I think a new game is going on. I think liberal bias is real. I think it's out there and it exists. But I also think the right in particular now is defining bias as anything that makes them uncomfortable. You pay attention to Abu Ghraib, that's bias. You pay attention to Richard Clark's book during the campaign, that's bias. That's nonsense. Those are big stories. And I think that's an active campaign, and it's you've got a president who says he doesn't read the paper. You've got an administration who says that the press is no more than another interest group. That's an organized thing. It becomes easy to dismiss anything that makes you uncomfortable. I actually think that's a dangerous game because there becomes no forum, no sort of place where we can talk ideas and the red America can talk to the blue America and all of that. I think that can be dangerous.
We try to be
what's
that.
Troubling about,
yeah.
I'm sorry if I could jump in.
Yes,
what's troubling about that is that the attacks are on political bias, on the perceived political positions of people, not necessarily on the reporting. CBS screwed up on its reporting, and that's what they addressed. I remember, to think back, Geraldo Rivera in Afghanistan reported on something from somewhere that he wasn't.
Right.
It didn't happen. Fox said nothing. Had that been Dan Rather, you can imagine how that would have played. I think we've moved past the standard of good reporting or question the reporting, question the work, but we've moved to simply questioning that person's political beliefs.
But Dan Rather was not exactly subtle about his political beliefs, and you know that people have been howling today, on the right in particular, but saying, why didn't you address the political angle here?
When you say Dan Rather hasn't been subtle about his political beliefs, in what way?
Well, I mean, Dan Rather's made speeches over the years expressing rather liberal viewpoint, not on camera, not when he's in his anchor chair, but out in public, in public life. And it seems to me that came back to bite him. People really saw that as opening up a wound and what after it in terms of his objectivity.
That's a fair point. If he's done that privately, I honestly have not heard that. Again, I mean, Dan has been such a lightning rod for so many years that I think it's not possible to have any rational debate anymore anyway. But I think the issue is the reporting, and we've lost that. But the overall problem is we in the journalism community have lost the trust of the people we're supposed to be serving. Mm-hmm. And quite honestly, I don't know how you get it back, and I don't know how you get it back when, from both the right and the left, people are continuing to hammer away at it. I honestly don't see a way out of it. I'm sure there will be. I certainly hope there will be. But it's gone so far that I'm not quite sure how you rebuild it, because simply doing good work isn't going to do it when someone is saying that work is biased simply because of where it plays.
So all kinds of parties and interests at play here, Jack Beatty. The listeners and readers and viewers, we hear. The media itself, a lot of competitive pressures and a kind of ripple-through effect from that. And then political groups trying to manipulate this sense that, well, no one's telling it like it is. So let's just go with the loudest opinion, or my opinion.
Yes, and skepticism, which is healthy, morphing into cynicism about anything, sort of a Cassandra effect. I'll kill the messenger. I don't like the message, therefore the messenger is biased. But, you know, in the 19th century, we had a party press. You didn't read. In fact, it survives to this day. You see newspapers with titles like Foster's Daily Democrat. Mm-hmm. Well, that doesn't mean it's a Democratic paper today. It did in the 19th century. Mm-hmm. And it was only around the turn of the century with Joseph Pulitzer and others that there was a turn toward, quote, objective journalism. And some people think that what we're having now, partly with the polarization of the country, partly with the proliferation of new media, is a return to the party press, where essentially people, Democrats read the Democratic paper or blog, and Republicans read theirs. And the idea that there's a common world, the objective newspaper in the middle, that is now, people have such skepticism toward it, and that the tendency of the time seems to be to, let's get back to that old party press, party truth.
Well, what about that, Jack? If it worked a century ago, can it work again? I mean, it feels poisonous after most a half century when objectivity
Absolutely.
Was the gold standard. Going back there feels very dangerous.
I agree with you.
But is it, in fact? I mean, the country survived it before, you're saying.
And some people say, look, people who read the party press are interested in politics. That's the point. You only get interested in something if you have a stake in it. The idea that the public is just some, you know, objective, neutral judge. No, people have biases, and that orientates them to a particular view of reality, and that's what politics is. Politics is argument about public life. The trouble is, you can't agree even on is it a rainy day, or is the sun out, and there you're in a world where everything, as you say, it's all relative, that's media bias.
Pretty soon you don't know what's up or down. Jon Stewart, the comic who hosts The Daily Show, very popular source of even news for a lot of Americans now, was on Crossfire in, October. He went after the hosts, Tucker Carlson and Paul Begala, saying they're turning everything into just a left-right swap fest where everything important gets lost.
The thing is, we need your help. Right now you're helping the politicians and the corporations, and we're left out there to mow our lawns.
You just said we're too rough on them when they make mistakes.
No, you're not too rough on them. You're part of their strategies. You're partisan, hacks.
You are hacks, not to put too fine a point on it, Jon Stewart there on Crossfire. And, of course, Crossfire now going off the air. Ruby is calling from Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Hi, Ruby. You're on the air.
Hi. I may be biased because I'm a blogger.
Okay.
But there are lots and lots of us out there. I originally was going to call in and say, you know, I didn't trust the press 10 years ago, and so I don't trust them any more or less now. Mm-hmm. It's just that I get alternative information from the Internet. But actually, now that I've been, through the course of the show, while I've been listening, you know, you reminded me how, for example, how many voters have just completely wrong information about facts, about how the government works. And that reminds us that the mainstream media isn't really doing its old traditional job of the fifth estate, you know, the sort of social, societal, really critical role, a democracy is based on people having actual information about things.
But Ruby, is it not doing its job, or are people just not listening, or are bloggers like you muddying the waters? I don't know. What do you think?
Well, you know, I've long felt that this idea of objectivity is sort of a lie, too, and that's part of why I didn't really trust the mainstream media to begin with, because most people have an opinion, and writing as if you don't have one is just as much of a lie. And so I sometimes I want to lean toward, as you were just talking about, sort of the partisan press, although, as you said, that leads to this sort of poisonous environment where everybody doesn't trust the other. But the fact is, if there's a media outlet that's reporting lies about, you know, whether there are weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, I don't trust that outlet, and I don't want to get my news from them. So maybe I do have to go to a progressive source because I trust them more.
And so maybe you're left with no choice but to sort of tie yourself to the mast of the political ship you want to be on. Ruby, thanks for that call.
Tom, can I jump in with a question for Ruby if she's still on?
Is that Michael? Leroy?
That's Leroy.
Leroy, yes. Yes, please, Leroy.
I'm just curious. I mean, the idea that, we can go to the Internet or we can get alternative sources, how do you know they're right?
Ruby, are you there?
Yes, sure.
How do you know that they're not biased? How do you know that their facts are right? How do you even know who they are? At least with the mainstream media, there is some accountability. You know who they are. There's generally sourcing. But I'm curious why you think that that is more trustworthy than anything else.
I think that's a great question.
If I can jump in there also, this is Mike Hoyt. The value of the opinion is really linked to the facts that are in it, the actual truth that's in it. Somebody's got to do the reporting.
Actually, I think the key to why people trust blogs, the people that do trust blogs, is mostly because they're written in a first-person voice, and it's the third-person sort of disconnected objective thing that sounds untrustworthy these days. Whereas when someone writes and says, "Dang it, I'm really mad about this thing," and if you read them regularly, then you have a sense of who they are. You have a sense of what their values are and whether they match with yours.
But the question is, what do they really know, Ruby?
Right. Well, I mean, you know, this is something you can't control, people's intake of information. You know, I value people who I think have a high regard for facts. And so that's one of the things that I like to see in a blog, maybe, but maybe other people don't care.
And who knows if the blogger is actually delivering them. Leroy Seaver's the point I guess you're making there. If there's a place you can call when the facts are wrong, then someone's at least answerable. But if there's not, if it's just out in cyberspace, well, who knows what's there?
I mean, Ruby, I can say I'm going to look outside and I believe that it's raining today. Well, it's not. I mean, how many times can someone look you in the eye and lie to you? It's about credibility. And I think in the end, you know, maybe I think the standards are the same. And just the fact that it's on the Internet or someone is in the first person or someone, you know, sounds credible, that really doesn't matter. It's record over time. It's attributing your sources. It's all of that is good reporting or bad reporting, no matter where it is. But to simply assume that that information is factual, I think, is a huge trap.
Jack Beatty, it was very popular 10, 15 years ago to be very dubious about the whole idea of objectivity, as Ruby says. And you've talked about this before in academia. Deconstructionism comes in and says, hey, there's no straight up or down. It's all perception. And pretty soon you're tumbling. Here we are. Objectivity was almost dismissed in some quarters. And the next thing you know, no one knows what the facts are.
Yes, and unfortunately, two of the largest scandals in recent years involved threats to objectivity. I speak of the New York Times and the Washington Post, both of which had to apologize for their uncritical passing on of government the government line about weapons of mass destruction.
Front
in
page, at length, mea culpa.
Yeah, now, that was saying we were being very objective, but we were the prisoner of our sources, and it just so happens that one of our sources was Ahmed Chalabi, who was also the source who was giving the Pentagon bad information about Iraq. So, in other words,
so an objective but not aggressive.
Exactly. Exactly. They were being objective. They were saying, we have sources and we're going on. But the paper really did a tremendous disservice, it seems to me, to the whole idea of objective journalism. Because if you believe anything about the New York Times, I at least used to believe they were straight. This showed they were bent.
We are talking tonight about the news media's credibility crisis and what's driving it. You can join the conversation. Leroy Seavers in L.A. and Michael Hoyt in New Jersey. Please stand by. Listeners, you can join us. Has the news media fallen down on the job or been cut down by partisan opponents? And does anyone believe in facts anymore? Or is it all about ideology, your perspective, whatever that may be? Have we left the age of reason? Is it all just arguments now? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the news media's credibility crisis. You've seen it at CBS this week, Armstrong Williams last week, on the take from the U.S. government, and not exactly understanding what was wrong with it. The New York Times, Washington Post, front page mea culpas over the past year, USA Today as well. What do you think? What does the public really want? Entertainment? Cheerleading? The facts? And how long can real journalism last if people just don't believe it. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined tonight from L.A. by Leroy Sievers, former executive producer of ABC's Nightline. From New Jersey by Michael Hoyt, executive editor of the Columbia Journalism Review. And now also from New Jersey by Jill Geisler. She teaches leadership, management, and ethics at the Poynter Institute. Jill Geisler, thanks for being with us tonight.
You have to apologize for a factual error. I'm in St. Petersburg, Florida.
Oh, I apologize incorrect. From St. Petersburg, Florida. Thanks for setting me straight there. Jill, you look at ethics and leadership. I'm looking here at a report called The State of the News Media, 2004, an annual report on American journalism, and it says that you've got competitive pressures and economic pressures and news staffs have been cut, and it just may be that the news media is serving up a less meaty report and succumbing to infotainment. How much of the fault for this credibility gap do you put on the media's shoulders?
Well, I think certainly the pressures that you are talking about are very real. I just spent this entire week with ethics fellows, and these are journalists from news organizations across the country, Reuters, the Detroit Free Press, the Oregonian, local news stations.
What are they saying?
News. And what they're saying is that they are struggling to make sure that the issues that we're talking about, you talk about Armstrong Williams taking $240,000. These are people who worry about whether the real journalists worry about whether or not they should keep the free book that the author sent them for a review. Okay, because
ought to pull their head up a little higher and look around. I mean that's important, but my God, we've got $250,000. A whore is a whore.
I'm using a little hyperbole to tell you that that's how serious they are about the issue of independence. That they don't take a free book. That let alone $240,000. That they have a concern that stories like this are sullying, because people don't know the journalistic process. They don't know what journalists have been trained to do and not do, because when they look at television, they can't tell an Armstrong Williams from a Jon Stewart, from an Oprah Winfrey, from a Chris Matthews, from an Andrea Mitchell.
And they're being told something else. Bill O'Reilly, today, the mainstream media, the free media, is becoming dishonest. It's the crux of the problem.
Setting up a straw man, you know, that's the way to win an argument is to try to redefine your opposition, is to try to redefine what they stand for, what they are, and to try to characterize them as wrong or evil. And I think that's what's being done, not just by Bill O'Reilly, because it isn't just conservatives criticizing the media, it's liberals criticizing the media as well. What's distinctive about Bill O'Reilly and Fox News is that they purport to be giving you media information that has been gathered in the traditional fashion and disseminated in the traditional fashion, and it's not true. There's persuasion media, which is largely what Fox laces its 24 hours with, persuasion, and then there's news gathering. And news gathering involves heavy lifting. It's expensive. It's important. It involves, what I'd like to say is it involves starting out with an idea, not a conclusion, not an answer, but a question. And then it moves to a hypothesis, which is, you know, based on all this information that I've been trying to gather now and all the different points of view.
It takes a lot of staff, a lot of shoe leather, a lot of effort, as you say. But if at the end of the day the people don't believe it because it comes into a sea of opinion, or if it's not fully delivered because of cost cutting in newsrooms, you've got a problem. Bill is calling from Erie, Pennsylvania. Hi, Bill. You're on the air.
Good evening, Tom, and thanks for having me.
Sure.
I just had one quick question, one point I'd like to make. The suggestion's been made earlier by your listener, or by your guests, that people no longer trust the media. I might counter by saying that the media, in some extent, do not trust the public.
What do you mean by that, Bill? What's the evidence?
Well, what I'm saying is that they, as you have pointed out, and your guests have pointed out, is that the idea of moving away from news and moving towards the shouting and the hyperbole. Would indicate a lack of respect and a certain contempt for the public. And I see this happening in advertising as well.
Mm-hmm.
When I see a group of people staring up worshipfully at no more late fees or a salad with my hamburger, there's a certain disgust that I get from that advertisers as well as the media no longer seem to respect the public, don't trust them to divine the truth or the certain points of view from the facts.
And so they feel they can deliver anything, deliver infotainment.
Well, I think that's the case, is that, as you say, we see the trends not only at Fox, but we see it everywhere. as we see, you know, take the example of the Clifford Irving affair from the late 60s, early 70s.
Oh, that's going back.
But true. But again, what an isolated incident that was, as compared to today, where it's not surprising to see the icons of the media, such as the Washington Post and the New York Times, CBS, which was the ultimate news gathering organization at CBS in the past.
Right. And now the apologies feel almost like a drumbeat. Bill, we've got it, and thanks for your call. Leroy Severs, what about this issue of what the media delivers? We're looking here, again, in this report on the state of the news media, 2004. It says there's only one uptick in the last 18 years in the general approval or attitudes toward the news media, and that came in November 2001 after the terrorist attacks when the media got very serious for a little while and poured resources into a lot of very hard-edged factual reporting. Maybe the signal there is if you build it, if you do it, they will come.
I think in that time, the problem is, look at it now. I mean, these shows that deliver shouting or, heat but no light, they're not on the air as lost leaders. They're on the air because people watch. If people don't like these shows, don't watch, and they'll go away. But they are very, very successful. Somebody's watching. A lot of other serious shows are not.
And meanwhile, your show, Nightline, I'm reading here, lost 18% in its viewership in the last couple of years.
Exactly, and it's been going down. Actually, it's been going down every year in the 25 years that it's been on the air. We started doing Iraq every day. We thought this country's at war, that people are going to care about it, and the ratings started to plummet. So I think it depends on the tenor of the times. So I think the time after 9/11 was clearly, people were very concerned about what was going on. It swung back, though, and I got in trouble one time at a forum where people were basically saying the same thing. And I thought, the public gets the media it deserves in some extent because they determine who survives and who doesn't. You like serious reporting, watch it, it will survive. You like people yelling at each other, watch it, that will thrive, and that's where we are right now. Now, a whole lot of people, I think the other question is, have simply gone away. Those people are watching movies, they're watching cable.
Gone away from news, just not there.
Gone away from news. Mm. I mean, I have 300 channels on my cable at home, so
that's a couple of options.
Lots of stuff to watch.
Michael Hoyt, I do wonder about that. To some extent, isn't the media a kind of mirror of the public? If the public wants shouting matches and movies, they can have it.
Yeah, that's true. One point, though, on declining ratings. I mean, you look at ABC, and it's the nightly news has gone down, but the ABC News itself is reaching more people through because it's increased the number of news shows. Morning, it's online. It's got new shows all over the place. So the total number of readers or viewers it's reaching is actually increased. And I mean, one thing we can do about this is quit shooting ourselves in the foot with things like what happened at CBS. But I just want to make a point. We do have to look at the culture of our newsrooms and so forth and try to fix things that are wrong. I mean, my magazine makes a living criticizing the press, but on the other hand, we have to stand, I think journalists have to stand up for basic reporting and talking back and sort of and telling Bill O'Reilly should not get away with that, saying that the media is dishonest. It isn't. I mean, the fact that these things are stories, big stories, is because they're aberrations. What Mary Mapes did is wrong and a complete aberration.
60 Minutes. Mm-hmm.
And what the guy who took the $240,000, that's just off the charts. I mean, these are aberrations, and what 99% of the hardworking media do is nothing like that, and we have to say so more ferociously.
But there's a guy with a very big megaphone, O'Reilly, saying they're pushing lies, they're pushing lies, and I'm not sure exactly who speaks back to that. Scott's calling from Brookline, Massachusetts. Hi, Scott, you're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to say, I don't remember which guest, but someone earlier had said that, the polarization in the media is a reflection of the polarization, in the country, and
yes,
that Republicans are reading conservative papers, et cetera.
Red, blue, all the rest.
But I think that misses a point because the majority of the largest single voter bloc in the country are the swing voters, the moderates, who share some viewpoints with conservatives and others with liberals. And I'm a moderate, and most of my friends consider themselves moderates. And, we listen to NPR, but sometimes we also listen to, Jay Severin or somebody on a...
Sure, there's a lot of stuff out there, yeah.
Yeah, and so I think a lot of people are watching both, and I don't think it's a bad thing to have two opinions, to watch both and to make up your own mind. I think in some ways that's what the media should be.
That's a great point, Jack Beatty. It's sort of the free market view of the media. Let 1,000 views of reality blossom, and those folks in the middle will draw what they will from it. But even so, that seems kind of arbitrary what people end up believing.
Well, it does. And, you know, I saw some focus groups with independent, or at least I should say undecided voters this fall. And it was scary to me because they didn't seem to understand what politics was. They had such a meager raft of information they were operating from that they couldn't find their way into what was or what was not a political debate. In short, their divorce from politics, manifested in their sort of neutrality, was really a divorce from public life, from the issues of public life, and that they regarded those issues as sort of an imposition on them. And they didn't see them as legitimate. They didn't see political issues as legitimate. That was very frightening to me.
Hard way to run a democracy, yeah, when you're not engaged with what's going on. Julie's calling from Boston. Hi, Julie. You're on the air.
Hi. I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit about the fact that it feels like a lot of the media is owned by the same company. And once you dig a little deeper, you find that all of the channels are connected. A lot of the shows are connected.
Mm-hmm.
Part of what makes it really hard to trust, and that's part of why I listen to NPR, because I feel like at least it's funded. You know, I know it's, you know, there's the liberal bias that, you know, people have associated it with. Sorry.
So you want to know what it's tied back to on the corporate side. Jill Geisler, how about that? I mean, the Poynter Institute, no doubt supported by some of those big news corporations as well. But there, our caller looks up and says, hey, you know, they're looking for profits, not necessarily for the truth. How can I believe them?
Those big organizations do send people to our seminars, that's true. Those people they send do express concern about media consolidation and whether or not there are too few voices, because we're beginning to say, oh, by the way, when you're done writing for this, you can report for that, and we'll repurpose your material, and that we're investing more in the distribution of news rather than the gathering of news, which, as I said, is far more expensive than having two people argue with each other on television.
So who answers for the ethics of that issue? I mean, the shareholders in the media companies care about the dividend. They care about the stock price. They care about the quarterly report.
Right. It's a free market economy, only to the extent, however, that it is regulated or unregulated with respect to cross-ownership, and that is an issue before the FCC, which has been, in the opinion of many, underreported by the media.
Mm. Leroy Sievers, you're the guy who's just made the big move out of Nightline, out of that executive producer position. You must have been giving a lot of thought to what's going on here. Take us out tonight. We've just got a minute and a half left. What's on your mind about where the media stands today and its future? How do you see it? Deep depression. Looking at the media consolidation, and that's a major issue. Look at the morning shows, and they're interviewing stars from, you know, the shows on that network, or they're stars from the movies that, you know, that their parent company owns that movie studio.
Disney, whoever. Talk about incestuous.
Exactly. It's called synergy.
It's one word for it.
I feel terrible about it. I came up, I was in high school during Watergate. Woodward and Bernstein were heroes, and they were the good guys. And when I got into this business, I thought, great, I'm going to be one of the good guys too. Elie Wiesel gave a quote one time, and he said, the role of the journalist is to speak for those that have no voice. And I think that's what a lot of people that get into the profession want to do. You point out things that are wrong. You point out problems. And somehow we've lost that. We become just another player. We're not separate. We don't have a higher responsibility, either that we feel necessarily or that the public lets us have. I wish I had some good news. I wish I could say, boy, it's all turning around. I am not happy with the way it's going. I'm very depressed about it, actually.
Well, listeners, listen to the right thing. Listen for real news. And journalists, do the right thing, whatever that may be. Leroy Sievers, longtime executive producer at ABC's Nightline, now at the University of California's Annenberg School for Communication. Thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you. Actually, I need to correct because they'll kill me tomorrow. It's at USC, not the University of California.
Got it. Thanks very much. And Michael Hoyt at the Columbia Journalism Review, thank you for being with us tonight.
Glad to be here. Thanks.
And Jill Geisler at the Poynter Institute, thanks so much for joining us.
Good night.
Jack Beatty, good to have you.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.